This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Joining me on the Johncast today is Zoe Lionheart from the University of Bristol. Hello and welcome to the Johncast.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, this is excellent. And now you work on the formation of planetary bodies.
This is true.
Can you tell me some more about your research?
Yep. So I have a small group in the University of Bristol, in the astrophysics group in the School of Physics, and our primary objective is to try to come up with a coherent model of planet formation from protoplanetary disks up through planets. And at the moment, that is far too broad a time frame to model. And we are trying to chunk away at it piece by piece. So I started doing numerical simulations of sort of the middle phase of planet formation, where you don't really have to concern yourself so much with the gas, because you start with planetesimals or objects that are about the size of an asteroid, and then integrate them in a numerical simulation on a computer until you get up to moon-sized objects. But now we would really like to be able to go all the way up to planets, and our primary motivation is the diversity of extrasolar planets that have been detected. So there are just so many planets of sort of every flavor, shape, size, around any type of star. It's just really pretty insane. And that's really motivated me to try and come up with a coherent model that can go from this kilometer-sized objects all the way through multiple planets. And then hopefully, maybe in another 10 years, we'd be able to hook that onto the first part of planet formation. And my students are really working on trying to connect various phases, very specific phases of planet formation, with observations of those particular phases.
So could you briefly describe how a planet would start to form around a star?
That is a very good question. So we have a story that we tell ourselves and everybody else. And it has two versions, and it does depend on whether or not you're talking about smaller planets or larger planets. But this story has never been observationally confirmed. So the idea is that you start with a lovely molecular cloud, you form a star, and the material in the molecular cloud that has too much angular momentum forms an accretion disk around the star.
So an angular momentum, you mean sort of a spinning disk around an object?
That's right. And towards the center of the spinning disk is your young, hot star. And as this disk of material that is accreting onto the star, slowly but surely, cools off, the minerals, the metals, anything above hydrogen and helium on the periodic table, form dust. And that dust magically clumps together to form kilometer-sized asteroid-like bodies that we call planetesimals, or the building blocks of planets.
Which is where your models start coming into things.
That's right. Then those kilometer-sized objects interact with each other gravitationally and run into each other because their orbits are crossing due to small perturbations from other planetesimals and from the central star. And they grow into lunar-sized objects, moon-sized objects, just from collisions. And then those moon-sized objects interact with each other on a much longer time scale, because now you imagine that this disk, which was really very densely packed and full of lots of dust and debris, and slowly the optical depth or the space between the objects increased as you decreased the number of objects. Now you really have a lot of space between each object. It's sort of cleared its own zone. It's eaten out all of the little bits of objects that it could, all of the little bits of mass that it could eat in its own orbit. And so now you have maybe, you know, 10s, 20 of these moon-sized objects would fill up sort of our own solar system at this phase in planet formation. And so their interactions, the interactions between these moon-sized bodies, take a lot longer. And so they interact with each other again through gravitational interactions, and eventually they hit each other. And when they hit each other, they grow. And you maybe have a few of these giant impact events, and then you end up with a system that's totally stable and no longer evolving in any perceivable way. And that's when we sort of assume that we have our stable planetary system.
So is that for the big objects, the bigger planets, or is that
right
for the littler planets?
So, very good. So That is our standard story for cores of larger objects and terrestrial bodies. But there are also another method or hypothesis for planet formation for large planets and for planets that are far from their star, that we've observed to be very far from the star. And that would be about 100 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So if there are planets out at about 50 AU to 100 AU, and they're quite large, quite massive, like several Jupiter masses, it's hard to understand how they could go through this process because the collision timescale out there is so long. They just don't have enough time to form. So the idea is that out there, the disk is very cold, it's very dense, there could be a direct gravitational collapse, and you could form your planet very quickly if the disk gets cold enough and becomes gravitationally unstable, so it can't support itself against the thermal pressure. And it just collapses directly, basically like a star, but it's like a secondary star in a disk.
So it's sort of like finding forming a binary system, but with one large enough to make nuclear burning and the other one not big enough for that.
Yes, and the second one formed out of the material that never made it onto the first one. Instead of sort of having them form at the same time or from the same parent, so they don't form directly from the same molecular cloud, but the second object, which we call a planet, but sort of goes through this different kind of process, is really a secondary object that is forming the same way that you would think of a star forming in a molecular cloud, in a very general sense, but it's formed from a thin disk of material, not a spherical distribution, and it's just that gravity has won out over the thermal pressure of the disk at that location.
Okay, so could you tell us now about how you look in detail at these systems with your models, your numerical models?
So as I mentioned, none of this story is really observationally confirmed. And in addition, each phase of the formation process has to be numerically simulated on its own, independently at the moment. And this is primarily due to two factors. One is just our computational ability. Our computers are still not big enough for us to be able to do the entire problem. So each phase of the process is simplified, and those simplifications don't apply to the whole process. They only apply to that particular phase that you're looking at. And that way we can do those phases. But then when we hand off to the next phase, we often don't use the result from the previous phase. We often have to simplify even more than that. And so what I've been trying to do is two things. One, connect some of the easiest phases together, and the other is to try and figure out if there are indirect tracers that would allow us to make observations of those phases without actually having to observe the objects that are effectively invisible to our telescopes. So for example, in the middle phase of planet formation, where we're talking about asteroid-sized objects moving up to lunar-sized objects, those objects are very hard for us to detect. They're hard for us to detect in our own solar system. So you can see Kuiper Belt objects, for example, but we're just pressed at being able to see the largest ones, all of them, in our own solar system. We're just able to do that, and we certainly can't get a lot of information from them. So it would be a lot easier, for example, if that zone was still collisionally active, if the Kuiper Belt was still collisionally active, to be able to see the dust that those collisions produced. And so we are trying to come up with numerical simulations that would allow us to predict the amount of dust that you would see during these processes, and then figure out where we would have to, what kinds of stars would we expect to see them around, and then how could we make an observation of that. And that means that we need to have a collision model that accurately predicts what happens when these two objects hit each other. And so that's what I've been working on for several years, is coming up with an efficient but accurate collision model so that we could still evolve the solar system, a young solar system, through to protoplanets, but we would be able to predict how much debris accurately you would be able to see and what it would look like. So that when ALMA, for example, gets to be fully functional, this region would be sort of in the terrestrial zone, and that would be within ALMA's reach. And certainly dust is something that ALMA can see. That's what we're really going for at the moment.
So at the moment, these tiny planetesimals are just so small and so cold that you can't differentiate them from any background. And that's why you can't see them.
So they're small, they don't generate their own heat, and they don't scatter enough light from the star to make it visible. Whereas dust has a large surface area to mass ratio, and there's a lot of it, and it would be very visible.
So it's very good at reprocessing the light from the star.
Yes, even though you would have even though you would have very little mass in comparison to the parent population, you would still have much higher likelihood of being able to observe it. And the other thing that you would be able to observe, if you had a good enough telescope, are non-symmetric or interesting features in the accretion disk that would indicate that there were other bodies there that were gravitationally interacting with the dust.
So when you start off with your model, you have lots of clumps of small material. How big would these be to start off with initially?
Oh, that's a very good question. And it does depend on the specific simulation. But they're anywhere between 10 to 100 kilometers in size.
Okay. And for a star like a sun, for instance, mm-hmm. how many of these would you have around to start off with?
In our numerical simulations, we can easily do 1 million planetesimals. So often my graduate students use 1 million, but we can go up to at least 10 million. And we are trying to recode our evolution code so that we could run it on something like a GPU and do something even bigger than that. So what we have to do then is just start with an annulus of material. So we don't do the entire solar system, for example. We only do one AU swath with 1 million particles in it.
Wow. And then these all collide together and then they coagulate to form bigger and bigger bodies. And then where does the end of that stop in each simulation?
Right. So around a single star, that's absolutely correct. You just put a disk of 1 million planetesimals down and you turn on gravity and allow them to collide with each other and they grow. And they go through several known phases of growth. When you put them and we normally stop when we get to moon-sized bodies, so when we get to about a dozen large objects, we basically stop for this part of the simulation. But we are hoping that in the next few years, we will be able to continue that process all the way up to, so we would only stop when we actually got Earth-sized objects, and there were basically no other objects for these planets to eat, then we would stop. Yeah. But that would mean that we would have to transition to a different type of integrator. So right now we use a numerical integrator that is tuned so that it works very well for large numbers of particles, 1 million. But when you get to about, 13 objects, then you really want your orbits to be calculated very carefully, and you want your gravitational interactions between these rather massive, relatively massive objects to be calculated very carefully. And that requires a different type of numerical integrator than the integrator that we're using at the moment.
And the timescales will be longer for these
That's
bigger
right.
bodies as well to grow.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, it's about an order to two orders of magnitude longer, that second phase of evolution. And so you would want to have your code smoothly switch into a numerical procedure that is more efficient for that phase, exactly. When we put a disk around, if we look at extreme systems, which are a really good way of helping us to figure out if our planet formation story is correct, then we don't necessarily have growth where we expect to have it. So, for example, if we were to try and work on circumbinary planets like Kepler-34, Kepler-16, and we put a disk of 1 million particles around a tight binary system, then you have a very collisionally active zone where you don't have any growth, or you have very limited growth, and it's not clear that the planet would evolve where you detect the current planet in Kepler-34, for example. And so that's another problem that we are working on.
So have models so far been able to describe the growth of our own solar system?
That's a very good question. And I think that there are several layers to the answer. Models have for a long time been able to show that you can form terrestrial planets from kilometer-sized objects. So in that sense, we have shown that we can form our at least the terrestrial zone of our solar system. The rest of the solar system and the details becomes very tricky. I think depending on who you ask, some people would say that we haven't shown that we can form Mars. Either Mars is too large in these numerical simulations, or it's kicked out altogether. We never reproduce Mercury, which has a very large core, very, very thin crust, and is very odd indeed. We have a lot of trouble explaining the distribution of water in our solar system, and we have a lot of trouble explaining the ice giants. And so to zeroth order, so to first order, we know that we can show that planets form easily, but we haven't been able to reproduce the details. And we certainly haven't been able to explain why in some systems you would get one hot Jupiter, and in another system you would get terrestrial planets that smoothly transition to gas giants and then to ice giants with a volatile distribution that moves as you would expect from inside to out. And then we have these other crazy systems where you have multiple terrestrial super-Earth mass objects that are so tightly packed that they're just on the edge of stability. So they are stable systems, but they've stopped just shy of being unstable. And so we certainly can't explain why a planetary system around a star would evolve into hot Jupiter, why it would evolve into this tightly packed super-Earth system, or why it would evolve into our nicely ordered, separated system, where you have terrestrial planets, then gas giants, then ice giants. And that's one of the things that I am very interested in, is understanding what details in the numerical simulation are important to determining what happens later.
So all the Kepler data, for instance, and all the super-WASP data is just giving you a lot more of a conundrum rather than anything that can be explained so far.
It's giving us a lot more data to work with. I mean, I think that the first thing that it tells us is that planet formation is 100% efficient. So whatever star we have, whatever numerical simulation we start with, we should expect that it will always produce some type of planet. Whether or not, in reality, every main sequence star, you have a 1 in 4 chance of having a planet, or, you know, a 7 in 10 chance of having a planet, that's effectively, for numericists, 100%. And so that is helpful in the sense that whatever we're doing, it can't be hard. It has to be a process that actually works all the time. The diversity thing is, I mean, that's what motivates me, I think, to try and figure out if the diversity happens at the very end. You know, do you just have some interactions? Have you got masses of planets that reach a certain size so that they can migrate efficiently just before the gas disk is all accreted onto the star, and then it's all frozen in, and you just have some that just manage to do that at one point versus another point, so some are earlier, some are later, and some don't migrate at all? I don't know.
So a bit earlier on, you mentioned about disks and binary systems.
Yes.
How would the planets orbit around these objects?
Okay, so there are two types of orbits that we have found planets on in binary systems. One is around one star, so a primary star, a planet orbiting one star. Now, that isn't always the more massive of the binary partner. It could be the less massive, but it's sort of the primary for the planet. Or you can have a circumbinary planet. And Kepler has detected several circumbinary planets. And these are planets that orbit around binary stars that are so close that they have, we assume, a shared accretion disk. They didn't have two separate accretion disks as they formed. They have a shared accretion disk. Kepler-34b, for example, is a planet that is sub-Jupiter mass. So it's about 2/10 of a Jupiter mass. And it orbits around a binary system that has two stars of roughly equal mass. They're both G-type single solar mass stars. And they orbit each other with a semi-major axis of 0.2 AU and eccentricity of 0.5. So they're very, very close to each other, but fairly eccentric. And one question that's immediately raised is, did the planet that is orbiting these two stars form where we see it? Or did it form further out in the accretion disk and migrate inward? And if it did, how far away would it have to have been in order to be in a zone where these collisions would result in growth? And how far did it have to move? And how many other planets could have formed in the system? And one of my graduate students is currently working on direct numerical simulations to probe which zones are friendly for accretion. And the reason that we are particularly interested in this is that we actually have a bit of a disagreement in the community. Some earlier work has suggested that actually these sub-Jupiter mass planets could have formed where we find them. And the work that I've been involved in suggests that the zones so close to the star are not accretion friendly, but they are stable. So you could form the planet further away and then move it inward and it would stay there on a stable orbit. But what my graduate student has found so far, he's only done a few orbits because this required that we have, again, a very accurate but efficient collision model. And so we've gotten our new collision model integrated into our evolution code. So he has only been able to do about 100 binary orbits so far, but he has found that even in the accretion unfriendly zone, this erosion zone very close to the star that has stable orbits, so even though most of the collisions are erosive, every now and then there is an accretion friendly collision. So there's a great overlap between the outcomes of the collisions. And so you can't be sure if you're in a particular zone that will just mean flat out there's no growth. And this raises the question, well, how often do you have to have a growth event in order for the planets to continue to grow or for the planetesimals to continue to grow? And so could you just have a few lucky guys in there? And would that result in growth because the collision frequency is so much higher closer to the stars, they have a lot more collisions, so they evolve more quickly. And that's what he's working on right now. And he's also going to look at if there are any observational signatures, any dust produced, that would then allow us to try and look for this process ongoing, as opposed to just being able to look for the final event and explain it.
So at the moment, what can we actually observe in planet formation?
Okay, so I think we can observe the very early stages when we have a hot, dusty disk that's optically thick, a protoplanetary disk. We can observe the end result. We can observe the planets directly. We can observe their gravitational influence on the star indirectly. And if we're very lucky and we have some planets far away from the star, we can observe them when they're fairly young and still hot. We can also observe debris disks. It's a little bit unclear. Most of the time, those debris disks are very old. They, again, were probing the end stages of planet formation. So these are disks of asteroid or Kuiper belt-like objects. The ones that we observe are very heavy disks. Those are disks that have a lot of mass in them, very much more massive than our own disk. So they might indeed be at a different phase of evolution. Theoretically, we can also observe inner belts like that are producing dust. And in some systems, we have observed things like that. And new telescopes will get us much closer and much younger. So anything that produces dust, anything that will become optically thick or can scatter a lot of stellar light, that's what we can observe. We won't be able to observe the planetesimals directly. That will not be within our reach for the foreseeable future. With ALMA, I'm hoping that we will be able to probe down to 10 million years and actually confirm that planet formation is ongoing. And that would be incredibly exciting because I think right now we're sort of orders of magnitude away. We're at hundreds of millions of years. And so if we can get an order of magnitude closer to the beginning of planet formation, that would be very, very exciting.
So your numerical models allows you to predict what observations you'll be able to see in
this
range.
I hope so. That's what we're working on. So I hope in the next year or so, we will have results that would suggest that we would be able to detect systems that are forming or very young, have a very young Jupiter mass planet and haven't formed terrestrial planets yet, but would be observable with ALMA, and that we would be able to detect the indirect signatures of dust from collisionally active zones in those systems. Yes.
That's excellent. I wish you lots of luck.
Thank you.
I'd love it if you could detect this because that would be really exciting. Thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.